Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, I'll speak with author and journalist John Jeter about the effects of globalization over the last 30 years. First, the University of Louisville recently opened a new medical clinic. That sounds like everyday news, but this clinic is one of only a few like it in the country. It specializes in the medical issues that accompany international adoption. Stephanie Sanders spoke with the clinic's director, pediatrician Mike Howard, about the clinic, why it's needed, and the medical problems many adoptive parents face when selecting a child from overseas.
We are prepared to begin seeing patients now. We meet twice a month, and it is a new entity at the University of Louisville. And we offer a full service for families who are going through the adoptive process, and from before they actually bring the child into their family through their visit overseas to pick them up and bring them back in the country, helping them acclimatize and do the proper laboratory and evaluations and testings that need to be done, and developmental assessments, and help them acclimatize to the wonderful addition and being part of their forever family now.
So what sorts of things do maybe people who have never been through an international adoption process, I guess, what sorts of things are we maybe forgetting that these adoptive parents are facing in these decisions and in that process of bringing that child back to the U.S.?
Well, it can be a pretty daunting process itself. Just think about, even having a newborn child that biologically you bring into your family. It's an exciting time, but there's an adjustment period. And of course, when they adopt internationally, most of the time they're not getting newborns. These children are anywhere usually from 6 months to a few years of age, and they have been raised in a different environment and culture altogether, and so when they come in, they have to assimilate and get used to the United States and what goes on in their American family, and then the American family also has to realize the experience that their adoptive child has gone through. Some of these children have been in orphanages, and the amount of attention they have gotten could be a lot, or it could be somewhat minimal. Every case varies so much, and it varies so much from country to country. So there's a lot of things for the family to think about. Even just reviewing their immunization status, we have found that from some developing countries, possibly they may show that they've had immunizations, but they may have used outdated stock numbers, or they may not have been stored properly. So all that has to be assessed. And then again, their development aspect is very important. When we first started doing this, and people were actually working with families and realizing what needs to be done for these children when they come in the country, the logical thing at first we thought would be a big factor would be infectious disease issues. You know, we have more concerns with things like hepatitis C in some other countries, or HIV, and so we would screen for these infectious processes, different gastrointestinal disorders and parasites and things like that. But we find those are pretty easy to do and deal with and discover. But the main thing over time is anybody that's been doing international adoption from a physician's aspect discovers is that these children have more developmental problems as they come in. And again, helping the families acclimatize and the child to assimilate within their new family. So we've had to offer a broader compendium of services for people rather than just the traditional screening for blood tests and stool samples and cultures to look for those aspects of things. So there's a lot that can go into it.
So you guys have people like counselors and things like that on staff now?
Well, what we've done at the University of Louisville with our clinic, again, I've had a lot of experience in this in a private sector. What I wanted to do was to create a facility where we could offer a la carte aspect of things for all these families of the different services that they may need. And we've put together a team here at the University of Louisville. And am the director and work in the aspect of doing the initial screening evaluations and working with the families pre-adoption, reviewing their records and answering any questions they may have, and also can provide email services when they're overseas. So within a 24-hour period, we can get back with them to answer their email questions. Most people have laptops and things that they travel with now. And then evaluate the child when they come in the country and decide where we need to go from there. Now, also on our team, we have a pediatric infectious disease specialist who even has his own subspecialty interest in international travel. We have a pediatric developmental specialist. We also have a physical therapist, occupational therapist, speech therapist, and a clinical psychologist, all a part of the team. And we use the same people all the time, so we get great continuity and allows all of us to develop our own expertise in working in this field and with specific families. So I think it will be a wonderful service for our community and general area.
Sure. How did this get started because it was something you wanted to do and that you kind of spearheaded, or did you see, I guess, do you have an example of how you saw a need for this and maybe some other patients or something like that?
Well, exactly. I had been in private practice for over 24 years in Louisville before I joined the academic faculty at the university 3 years ago. And I had always had an interest in international adoption through my private practice. 15 or so years ago, a family came to me before they had adopted a baby internationally from China and showed me the paperwork, and I had never dealt with this before. And in adoption internationally was really just starting to get off, to be a more popularized type of experience for people. And I had to research so much of this myself, and it was confusing, and I didn't know what to do about the immunizations, what test I had to do on this child when they came in. And so I called people, I researched it, and I checked with the American Academy of Pediatrics and pieced it all together myself. And so after seeing one child, the next thing you know, I had another and another and another, and sort of word of mouth spread, and I did a lot of children that way. And I always found that the families were just a delight to work with and highly motivated and excited to have these children. And it was, I think, wonderful what they were doing. They were, you know, taking in families or children from another culture and that may not have had as much of an opportunity to thrive had they not been adopted by these families. And it was a win-win situation all the way around, and always enjoyed working with these people. So I knew that there are a few clinics around the country. University of Minnesota has an excellent one that they had dealt with international adoption, and I thought that we could provide something for, you know, children in our region and in the Louisville area in particular, and especially if I could put together the team concept that we've done, it was a natural fit, and I've always enjoyed it and still do, obviously.
Do you find that you mentioned that it's quite a daunting process for the parents, but also for a physician who maybe hasn't gone through that process before. Do you find the clinic getting referrals from physicians who, you know, someone shows up in their office and they say, I just don't have the time to do all this research. Here are these people who are specialists in this.
Exactly. They can certainly do that and, you know, just refer the patient to us. And again, our goal, we're not trying to become their primary caregiver. We just want to help them through the initial process and do the evaluations and take some of that decision-making process and learning process on us, so that their primary care physician won't have to deal with the initial thing, and then of course, you know, they will take care of their day-to-day, you know, care. We can provide some ongoing follow-up if they have developmental issues and help them with that is they've been in the country for a few months. But, it, you know, we, of course, respect and want the primary care provider to be involved and spearhead everything. But also, we can answer questions. This week alone, I've had two or three physicians from the state call me and ask questions about what do you do with immunization status on some of these children, and do I need to screen for syphilis? Just simple questions like that that I'm able to answer for them and happily, you know, in a consultative manner over the telephone too. So we're just here to help in any capacity we can.
How long has the clinic been running?
Well, it's just started. It's been in the offing literally for a couple of years. I had suggested when I joined the faculty something like this, and it's taken us a while to get some funding and put it in place. But we're ready to go now.
And I imagine as you get a little further into the process and maybe knock out some of the kinks and things like that, I'm sure you probably have ideas of where you'd like to see it go or expand, maybe?
Well, yeah, I've got a lot of ideas in that regard. We're trying to work a little bit in doing some of this as a clinic without walls. And by that, I mean we can open our expertise up nationally. And at least with the wonder of the Internet, can at least review records and things for people around the country and without ever seeing children. As a matter of fact, I had helped a lady from Houston who contacted me before we had the clinic really formally running. She was going to adopt a child from the Ukraine, and I went through some of the medical records that she had, and she was trying to decide if she wanted to adopt this child at all. She was a single parent, and was not in a position where she could handle a child who had special needs. And so we were able to review those records. She went to the Ukraine and visited, which was their process through the agency that she went through. They would go initially, visit the child, then would come back and decide if they were going to go through with the adoption process. So she went over, she took some photographs. I had some initial concerns in reading the medical records about a few things. And when she came back, she was very excited. It was an 18-month-old little girl, and she thought she was very vibrant and cute and interactive when she was there with her. But they did allow her to take some still photographs. They would not allow videotape, but from those still photographs, there were a number of facial features that had concerned me that I thought that the child may be what we call a fetal alcohol syndrome, and was able to have her delve a little deeper and get some further information about the birth mother, which is often hard, but she was able to do that. And she found that the birth mother had been in a clinic for alcohol rehab for previous pregnancies, but stated that during this one she was not. But looking at the physical features of the child, I found that hard to believe. So at least we were able to give her information on things to look out for and to be concerned with, and so she could make an informed decision about the adoption. And she went ahead and did this, and she's very happy with her her little girl. But she is, you know, now aware at least of things that she might have to look out for and deal with in the future. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we can do and open that up on a national level, I think. But there are other aspects that we would like to work through. I have dealt with many families, and when we developed our clinic, one of the things I did was talk to quite a few families who had already gone through the process and asked what could have been done to facilitate things, and what service would you have liked to have seen. And so we've incorporated all of that in our clinic. But the one thing that I don't think anybody does that is sort of interesting to me, some of them would say, well, we like this and we like that, but what we would have really liked to have had would have had to have been you go with us when we picked the child up. And that sounds sort of funny at first, and If it would just be one family, it would be difficult to do. But we have actually looked into the aspect of if there are large groups of people traveling, of possibly having a physician go with them. I don't know medically, legally, how that would fly yet. We're looking into those aspects. But that's just an aspect of things, how we might expand. And we're also going to look at doing some demographic research for all our kids that come into the country, to see if there are certain things that we see with Guatemalan children that we don't see with Ethiopian children, that we don't see with Chinese children, that we don't see with Russian children, just from our own interest point of view, and provide some useful information for both families and physicians.
Thanks for your time, Mike. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, Stephanie.
John Jeter is a former foreign bureau chief for the Washington Post, having served in Southern Africa and South America. Jeter has written extensively about globalization, monetary policy, deregulation, and related topics. His thoughts about the effects of globalization over the past three decades are included in a new book, Flat Broke in the Free Market: How Globalization Fleeced Working People. Jeter will discuss his book Tuesday at the Louisville Free Public Library. He spoke to us from his home in New York. This is a complicated topic, of course. I don't know if we could sum it up in just a few minutes, but generally speaking, what happened? Why is globalization that created, as you put it, so much poverty?
Well, it is. It is tough to sum up sort of succinctly, but essentially, over the last 30 years throughout the world, really beginning with the test case in Chile in 1973, exactly in the hours after the coup there, where General Augusto Pinochet was in the midst of overthrowing the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. They were printing up sort of a blueprint, basically a blueprint that was really sort of a model for an economy that was sort of what economists would call a classical macroeconomic model, one that was based very much on keeping inflation very low, almost at all costs. These very draconian efforts to sort of kill inflation, to sort of make investment, to emphasize investment, and to make investment pay, and to de-emphasize manufacturing. And these were, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but these were things like monetary policy and how sort of you allow money to flow in and out of the country, how quickly you can allow money to flow in and out of the country. And this is hot money. It can overheat an economy. And that's exactly what happened. And so what you've seen basically is the rest of the world has, including the United States, has sort of followed this model of deregulation, of privatization, of this sort of very austere and kind of almost antique monetary policy based, you know, roughly on the gold standard contractionary policy, all of which keeps inflation low, but at the same time it kills manufacturing, and manufacturing, of course, is the key to an industrial but also sort of an egalitarian, any kind of egalitarian economy that sort of distributes benefits sort of across a broad spectrum.
Did anyone have the foresight to anticipate this downside that you write about?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. It's one I can't. I'm not in the room for any of these discussions, and so I can only guess. But I believe, you know, these are not things that are mysterious to us. I mean, we know what happens. Economists know what they know. What happens when you, for instance, like in Argentina, when you peg the currency there, the peso to the dollar on a 1-to-1 basis. So basically, if you have to hold one U.S. dollar in your treasury for every peso that you print, you know, economists know exactly what that will produce. It will produce low inflation, but it will absolutely kill your manufacturing, because it means that all the goods that you export become automatically much more expensive. All the goods coming into your country become a lot less expensive. So it's going to kill manufacturing. So, yes, I think the people did know. They knew exactly what was going to happen. But this is the economy they wanted. It's one that emphasized, that really promoted speculation as opposed to the productive sectors of the economy. I think they did know.
Well, you take us all around the world in your book, but as you've already mentioned, a lot of focus on South America. Is that something that began there and kind of spread from there?
South America is really fascinating for a lot of reasons. One is because, of course, like I said, this is where it really began, was Chile. Chile was the, and Milton Friedman, the late sort of father of neoliberal economics, of this sort of Washington consensus and market fundamentalism, talks about how Chile, with the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet, provided the opportunity to sort of really to try out all these ideas that he had about market fundamentalism, about basically a wide open free market where there was a very, very little government intervention or regulation. And so Chile started it, and it failed miserably. And what they had was, and of course this will be familiar to any of your listeners, what they had in Chile basically throughout the tenure of Augusto Pinochet between 1973 and roughly 1989, were these periods of tremendous, these booming economies where 1 year would grow 10, 11, 12%, and 2 years later there would be a recession, negative 2% growth, flat growth. This boom and bust economy, basically, that's what this neoliberal model has yielded, has produced. And so you see in South America, Chile started it. It failed them miserably. At one point they had unemployment rates of 33%. They pulled back, and they started pulling back at the exact same time that this exact same model was spreading all around the rest of the continent. So they were pulling back, starting to invest more in education, more in the transfer of technology from the public sector to the private sector, more in health, starting to regulate the economy more at the exact same time that Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina was starting to adopt this old model of neoliberalism. And so what you've seen is that since 1990, Chile has had the fastest growing economy, not 10, 11, 12%, but sort of steady 4, 5, 6% a year. And they've had the fastest growing economy in Latin America for the last almost 20 years now.
What's the Obama administration's approach to all this?
I don't think we exactly know yet. I mean, I think, what's happened over the last 30 years is that our political class has made, I don't want to sound too much like a conspiracy theorist, but our political class has made a very clear choice between the banking sector and the manufacturing sector. And you see that really with the bailouts of the banks and the bailout of the Detroit and the auto manufacturers. And you see there that there is a very clear that they favor the banking industry, that there are demands made by the workers in Detroit, the UAW, that are not being made by the banking community. And the banking community, the banking industry is really a lot more central to our economy. So in other words, we really need to get that right. And the auto industry provides a lot of jobs for people. This is something that there's a very clear choice that's being made here about who we punish and who we reward. I mean, essentially, the banking industry is being rewarded for very, very bad behavior. I mean, Barack Obama, as a candidate, talked about moral hazard and whether or not we reward, homeowners, for instance, by bailing them out when they've made bad choices with loans. Well, apparently moral hazard doesn't apply to the banks. The banks are being bailed out with no sort of price to pay. So they are encouraged to do this kind of thing again. Well, Detroit has many, many problems, not the least of which is that they make bad cars. But there is a real sort of contribution that Detroit makes and that the auto manufacturers make to the public good because they provide decent paying jobs for a lot of people. And I don't think that's been recognized yet by the Obama administration. So it's still early. I still have hope. But so far, I think, it's been a continuation of this policy that favors speculation finance over manufacturing.
What kind of reaction have you gotten to the book thus far?
I think mostly positive. I think one thing that people are asking me, and I don't have the answers for. I'm not an economist. I'm a journalist, and I don't have the answer for. Is this, what do we do? And I don't know exactly what we do. I don't think there's a one size fits all sort of policy. I know where we need to get to. What we need to get to is back to an economy that focuses on the productive sectors, on actually making things. One that is, inflation is a problem. Inflation, everyone hates inflation, poor people, wealthy people. But, your economy can still grow and produce with a little bit of inflation. It's when you try to make inflation zero and that kills your production levels, which is what we've seen here over the last 30 years. Well, that's when you see this sort of widening inequality. You see you know, people who are increasingly isolated from the workplace, but also from their communities in a lot of ways. And so, you know, there are very specific things we can do. How we get there, I'm afraid I don't have the answers. I've been asked that a lot, and I have to tell people we need a political theorist to sort of write the follow-up to this book and tell us how we get there.
Well, the name of the book is Flat Broke in the Free Market, How Globalization Fleeced Working People. The author is John Jeter, who will be coming to Louisville on Tuesday to speak at the Louisville Free Public Library. John, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
John Jeter's appearance in Louisville is part of the Free Public Library's Authors at the Library series. His Tuesday discussion begins at 7 p.m. More information can be found at our website, wfpl.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer visits Udell Gardens to report on its recent exhibit of sculptures. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll learn more about the unveiling this week of the much-anticipated Lincoln Memorial at Louisville's waterfront. First, animating gardens with sculpture is an ancient art that was practiced by the Babylonians, Greeks, and Romans. Today, modern public gardens are increasingly incorporating contemporary art into vistas. The latest is Udell Gardens, just east of Louisville. Elizabeth Kramer went to the gardens to see why.
Among clusters of ferns and hostas under the shade of a pine tree at Udell Gardens, Louisville artist Brian Holden has just installed a towering sculpture. It's made of steel and blue glass, and it surprises Carla Drover, Udell's assistant director.
Where in your wildest imagination did you come up with this idea?
Well, my current series of work is titled Connecting Lives.
In Holden's piece, a glass hand reaches up from the soil toward a gleaming silver hand hanging from an elevated pod. It's just one of 60 pieces in Udell's Sculpture in the Dell that opens this weekend. The staff started this annual exhibit last year with outdoor sculpture by regional artists. Sculptures are now spread throughout the 33 acres here. The idea for the show actually came from regional sculptor Don Lawler. Drover says the show's success proved that such an event was inevitable for this four-year-old organization.
Art in a garden was just a marriage that was just waiting to happen. It's the type of thing that gives you something else to admire and enjoy. And people create some pretty incredible things.
Paul Capiello is Udell's executive director. He says this year's exhibit is bigger.
There are 60 pieces that range all the way from a little portable, something you can just pick up and move around, to 7,000 or 9,000 pound chunks of limestone that require a crane.
Mounting an exhibit of this scale has taught Capiello and Drover how to place a wide variety of outdoor sculpture, and that many sculptors in the region want more venues to show and sell their work, especially large pieces that are costly to transport to faraway venues. The first show expanded Udell's audience to art aficionados and turned garden enthusiasts onto art. It also attracted about 4,000 people, double the visitors from the same months during the previous year, and more than 15 sculptures were sold from the exhibit. Those results don't surprise Jeff Bright.
I've always said that sculpture is hugely popular, but only if you can get a lot of people to see it.
Bright is the son of one of Louisville's most notable sculptors, Barney Bright. He died in 1997, but his work is in front of the Mazzoli Federal Building in downtown Louisville and the Floyd County Public Library in Indiana. Bright also fostered other sculptors, including Ed Hamilton, who made the African-American Civil War Memorial in Washington, D.C. Jet Bright runs the Bright Foundry in Louisville's Butchertown. For this year's exhibit, the Bright family decided to create four pieces from molds their father made. Locally, large sculptors, especially those by Bright, have been popular for years, but only recently has the use of contemporary sculpture at botanical gardens become more widespread. Glenn Harper, the editor of Sculpture magazine, says pairing contemporary art and gardens really took off after a 2001 installation by glass artist Dale Chihuly at Chicago's Garfield Park Conservatory.
It's the first one that caught my attention and a lot of other people's attention, and they had a lot of success with it as a marriage of two different kinds of experiences for the visitor.
Chihuly's work went on to show in gardens nationwide. In Kentucky, Carla Drover says Udell has considered building the exhibit by inviting one nationally known artist. But she doesn't want to stray too far afield.
I think staying local is kind of what UDAL is all about. We grow plants that thrive locally, and we want to support the local economy, and I think this is where we're going to stay for a bit.
For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
A long-awaited memorial to Abraham Lincoln will be dedicated this week at Louisville's Waterfront Park. It includes a 12-foot sculpture of the 16th president and bas-reliefs depicting various stages in his life. It's part of the ongoing Lincoln Bicentennial Celebration. I spoke with Ashley Cox of the Waterfront Development Corporation about the free ceremony, which will be held on the evening of Thursday, June 4th. Cox begins by telling us that gates open at 8 p.m.
At that time, the public will have an opportunity to walk into the memorial, walk past all four of Ed Hamilton's bas-reliefs, and where they will then come across the sculpture of Lincoln, also created by Ed Hamilton, have an opportunity to view all of the pieces of art and reflect upon them. They can then go into the amphitheater and find a seat where the official program will begin at 8:45, which will involve a 50-piece orchestra performing works from the classical American composer Aaron Copland, and special readings, one by Ed Hamilton. And the finale, or the culmination of the event, will be a performance of Lincoln Portrait, narrated by William Maypother.
Now, William Maypother's a Louisville native and a pretty well-known actor now, right?
Very correct. He is an actor and a writer, and he is often known as the character Ethan on the series Lost.
And a cousin to Tom Cruise, I believe, as well, right?
That's correct, and he is also the nephew of Joan Ream, who was a very active person in Louisville Metro Government and a philanthropist in Louisville.
She was a deputy mayor, correct?
Correct. So he is near and dear to Louisville and very interested in what we're doing here.
Great. Now, this piece of artwork has been a long time coming, right? It's been a long time in the planning stages.
Well, just for this memorial itself has been about a four-year process. And probably from the time that Senator Dan Kelly approached the Waterfront Development Corporation about doing a memorial in Waterfront Park for Lincoln, that probably has been as long as 10 years. So this is it's a big day, and we're very excited to show the public all of the hard work that's gone into this.
And this, of course, is tied into the Lincoln Bicentennial Celebration.
Very correct. It is absolutely tied into the Lincoln Memorial Bicentennial Celebration, or the Lincoln Bicentennial Celebration, rather. And we have been working very closely with the Kentucky Historical Society on the development of the space in its totality, and also on the event. As well as the folks from the Kentucky Center, who've been very instrumental in helping us determine how best to honor the memorial itself with a program that is as fitting as the memorial itself.
So this statue of Lincoln and the complete memorial designed and put together by Ed Hamilton?
The sculpture and the art were put together by Ed Hamilton, and actually he worked very closely with Hargraves and Associates, who is the landscape architecture firm, who designed the master plan for Louisville Waterfront Park. So they actually worked in tandem to create the art within the context of the landscape.
And Ed Hamilton, for those who may not know, I doubt if there are in the Louisville area those who don't know who he is, but for those who don't, he's a nationally renowned artist from here in Louisville.
Very, very much so. He is a very special person in our community that is extremely talented, and we're so thrilled that he was able to get involved in this project.
Now, where specifically in Waterfront Park is this located?
This is a good question. This is located in between the Kennedy and the Big Four bridges. And as you're driving along River Road, many folks in your listening audience probably have been seeing the greening of this space for almost a year. that we have very mature trees in the space. The grass has grown, and it's ready to go and ready to be used and enjoyed by the public.
And this dedication ceremony is free and open to the public?
That is correct. It is free. We'll be giving away free water. The Kentucky History Mobile will be on site for those who want to go in and tour around, and the Speed Art Museum will also have a small table. And we're also going to be selling special Lincoln Memorial merchandise for those who want to take it home.
Okay, we look forward to it. That's coming up on Thursday, June 4th, 8:45 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., a sunset ceremony. Ashley Cox with the Louisville Waterfront Development Corporation, thanks for filling us in on all this, and good luck with the dedication.
Thank you so much.
More information about the Lincoln Memorial at Louisville's Waterfront Park can be found at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll hear from University of Louisville President James Ramsey. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. At last week's Rotary Club of Louisville meeting, University of Louisville President James Ramsey updated members on the state of the university. Here is part of his address.
I was at a function on campus the other night, and one of our folks said, with apologies to Charles Dickens, they said, this is the best of times and the worst of times. I don't know that I would put it quite that way. I would say it is a challenging time. But in challenging times, we see opportunities to do the very best we can, and that's been what we've been focused on at the University of Louisville. You know better than anyone, because you have to meet payrolls and you live with it every day, what's been going on in the economy over the last, really, almost 18 months. There have been 11 downturns, recessions in the national economy since World War II. I was actually born. I know the print's very small, but this starts 1948, way down here somewhere. I can't get my laser going. But since World War II, there have been 11 recessions in the United States national economy. And the current recession that we've been in since January of 08 is the deepest recession of those 11. The impact in Kentucky has been felt. And again, I don't know if you can really see this picture or not, but what plotted here is employment in Kentucky over the last 10 years. Why 10 years? Because 10 years ago, the people of Kentucky said to higher education, through the enactment of the Post-Secondary Education Improvement Act of 1997, that all of us in higher education have a public agenda, and that public agenda is to increase economic opportunity and the quality of life for the people of our community and state. And since we were given that mandate, if you look at what's happened to employment in Kentucky, a lot of people look at unemployment, but these are the people that are actually working. And if you go back a little over a decade, we had a little bit over 1,750,000 people working in Kentucky. And for the next 3 or 4 years, we saw a trend line, which is the trend line that we like to see, adding jobs every year, more people working, more people earning incomes for their families. And then we hit the recession. There was the national recession of 2001, 2002. It had a much more profound impact in Kentucky than it had nationally. And you can see as the line goes down during that period of time, we had significant job loss in Kentucky, and that translated to budget cuts at the state level, and we at the University of Louisville during that time period went through 5 budget cuts. But there are business cycles. We know there's ups and downs in the economy. We hit the trough in 2003, began to see nice job growth until about 14 or 16 months ago. And then you can see what happens to the employment line in Kentucky. It's been a straight downward drop. Now, why would a president of a university have as one of their bookmarks or favorites on their computer the Bureau of Labor Statistics employment data and track this day in and day out the way I do? is because there's a very simple correlation that when people are working, they're earning income and they're paying state income taxes, and they have money to spend on goods and services that are subject to the sales tax. The individual income tax and the sales tax make up about 75% of the state's general fund. So when people lose their jobs, we see a drop in state individual income tax, we see a drop in state sales tax, and we experience budget cuts. And so I mentioned this one period of time, we went through 5 cuts, we've now gone through 4 more cuts just in the last really 3 years. We've been through 9 budget cuts in 9 years, and tomorrow the Consensus Forecast Group, group of professional economists, will meet in Frankfurt. They'll deliver a new revenue forecast for the state budget for next year that starts July 1, and expectations are that revenue shortfall will be up to, could be as high as $1 billion, and we'll take our 10th budget cut in 9 years. What are your options when you're faced with budget cuts? One, we could say, we're just gonna throw in the towel and give up. We've been mandated to be to do certain things on behalf of the people of our state, but we're not being funded at the level we need to be funded to achieve that mandate, so we throw in the towel. Second option is we could just limp along, do the best we can, not worry about it. The third option, and we think the only option, is remain focused and committed and passionately committed to doing what we've been asked to do. And that's the approach that we've taken at the University of Louisville. We remain more focused than ever on the mandates that have been given to us, not only by the people of Kentucky in the Post-Secondary Education Improvement Act of 1997, but also the people of this community in 1996 with the Boyle Report. When this community came together and said, what are we gonna do to replace the lost manufacturing jobs that we're experiencing in our community? And we said as a community, we're gonna build new economic clusters. We're gonna build a healthcare cluster and a life science cluster. We're gonna build a logistics and distribution cluster. We're gonna, as a community, build new economic opportunity to replace those lost manufacturing jobs that we as a community are experiencing. The law of Kentucky says that the University of Louisville will be a premier, nationally recognized, metropolitan research university. That is in the law of the Kentucky Revised Statutes. That's in the law of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And that's our mandate, and that's what our focus is. Our Board of Trustees at the University of Louisville, shortly after the passage of the Post-Secondary Education Improvement Act of 1997, adopted a plan, a vision, with goals and strategies and tactics and metrics of performance that said, here's what we're going to do to achieve that mandate. And that plan was a 10-year plan. The Challenge for Excellence was a 10-year plan, 1998 to 2008. This is 2009. When we looked back last year, met with our board and went through where were we in terms of the goals that they had been set, we met the challenge. But we realized that while we've made a lot of progress at the University of Louisville, we've got a long way to go. And the board said, let's put in place the plan that will take us to the finish line, and the finish line is the year 2020. Because that's the date that was set in the Post-Secondary Education Act for all of us in higher education to be hitting full force and to achieve the mandates that have been given to us. So we have a new plan, the 2020 plan, and again, it outlines what we're going to be doing as we move forward, not only in terms of goals, strategies, tactics, but our metrics of performance. Now, how do you move forward and how do you make progress when you're going through state budget cuts? And yeah, tuition has gone up. There's no question about that. And tuition has gone up more than we would like for it to go up. We were a low tuition state. Today, our tuition at the University of Louisville is exactly at the midpoint of our peers and our benchmarks. We wish we didn't have to increase tuition, but we did. And we increased our financial aid programs, our need-based financial aid programs. We started a new program called the Cardinal Covenant, which says to any student in our state, not just in our community, that if their family income is below 150% of the federal poverty level, they can go to the University of Louisville free, no cost. So we've reached out to those to make sure those with the greatest need, to make sure that no one is left behind as we try to increase the level of education in our community. We've put in place 7 strategies to try to keep moving forward in a very difficult fiscal environment. Number one, re-engineer, continually look at our operations. How can we be more effective? How can we be more efficient? What can we do better? Secondly, we've been very focused on converting our underperforming assets to fully performing assets. And we've had a number of underperforming assets at the University of Louisville. And it's going to take a while for those assets to be fully performing. But the best example, and I'll come back to this in a moment, is our Shelby campus. Most valuable piece of property in Louisville and Jefferson County. Great place to walk your dog, great place to play soccer. But really wasn't, and we taught classes there, we had some activities there. But it was an underperforming asset. And if you drive on Hurstburn Shelbyville Road now, you'll see some things happening. We've turned the entrance from Shelbyville Road to Hurstburn. We put in new roadways. Our Bowel Safety Lab 3 is under construction. We'll open this fall. We've gone through an RFP to get a master developer for the campus. We're going to turn that into a performing asset. And so we're doing that throughout the university. Number three, increase our fundraising effort. Number four, enhance our clinical operations and our clinical income that flows back to the university to support our teaching mission and our research mission. You heard from Dean Halperin last week, and he's doing a great job with our education programs, our research programs, and our clinical programs. We have 460 physicians at the University of Louisville, specialists. And we weren't using our physician network as efficiently as we could. We weren't making referrals. We weren't doing single point contracting. Each different private practice plan at the university would negotiate separately for their provider payments with Humana and with Anthem and so forth. And so we, for the first time, have an outpatient clinic of our own where our faculty are not leasing space from other people. We, for the first time in history, have created a strong community-based board for the University of Louisville Hospital. The University of Louisville Hospital is a great resource in terms of the Level 1 Trauma Center that I know that you all talked with Dean Halperin about last week. We have a commitment to provide indigent care in this community, and we'll never walk away from that commitment. But we have some of the strongest medical programs in the state or in the region in terms of cancer, in terms of stroke care, in terms of our women's health programs and so forth. And there's more that we can do at the University of Louisville to support our University of Louisville Hospital, to support our academic mission. Through partnerships, private and public partnerships, there are things that the private sector can do for us that we can't do ourselves. Our sixth strategy is improving our contract research and commercializing our research. A lot of people will pay us and are paying us money for us to do research and to do various experiments for them, and we can do a better job there, and then just being creative. So those are the seven strategies. And just to talk about some of the things that we've been able to do. Henry talked about our budget. We've been able to cut $100 million out of our budget through a variety of efficiency measures. Some are big things, like refinancing debt. Everybody's doing that. Record low interest rates, homeowners are doing it, we're doing it, saving money. Our health insurance costs at the University of Louisville were killing us. We went to a self-insured program, put in a pharmacy management program, disease management program, went to our Get Healthy initiative and so forth. And this year, for the current year we're in, our health insurance premium increase were 0%. We've done some little things. Instead of washing windows every year, we're washing them every other year. The provost said, well, she didn't think hers were ever washed. But a little thing, we put on, our engineers figured out how to put on these power, these little machines on our vending machines so that in the evening hours and when vending machines aren't being used and drinks don't have to be as cold, we can cut down on the power use and save money there. So we've done a lot of things that have allowed us to reallocate dollars from where we were to our core academic mission.
That was University of Louisville President James Ramsey speaking at last week's Rotary Club of Louisville meeting. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Hallett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.